Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case for this morning is Banner Restorations versus Chicago Area Union. And Mr. Smetta?
Smurf.
The court. As I see the case, Your Honors, the critical issue, there are a number of issues, but the question of the timeliness, I think, is taken care of in the briefs, and I will come to the abuse of discretion, I think, after addressing the principal argument, which I see is.
Clear up one thing. There's a history of filing these extension requests here.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in one, you said that there was an unopposed request for more time. They dispute that. What's the state of the record?
Yeah, Your Honor. There's no question that this is you have reference particularly to the filing of June 5, 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, I had assumed it was to be unopposed, and I so labeled it. I could not reach Ms. Chapman, attorney for the appellee, but I assumed that she would grant it only because, as I indicated in the papers, I have I've been practicing, 40 years, and certainly for the last 25, I have a long-standing relationship with this firm, although we've always been the opposite side. And they have always granted my extensions, and I have granted their extensions. One of their senior partners has been quite ill through the years. It so happened I had some problems as well. And so I had assumed it would be granted. Obviously, as soon as I was able to reach her, which was later in the day that I had filed it, I immediately called the judge's minute clerk, Mr. Eric Fulbright, and apparently she had done so also. I had not realized that.
They contacted the court first to say this was not an unopposed.
Well, yes. Well, I had no way of knowing they contacted the court first, Your Honor. I found that out a month later in a letter of June 20. That letter was, in fact, filed with the court. In that letter of June 20, they informed me for the first time that they had contacted the court first. But in any event, from that letter of June 20, which is part of this record, I think twice, it's also attached, as is the letter of June 5 to my reply brief, it was clear that Mr. Fulbright, he's not a party, of course, he's the clerk, had indicated that he would submit the matter to Judge Norgal as an opposed motion. For some reason, it was never submitted, apparently, because it was never ruled upon. So when we came before Judge Norgal, on July 9, I believe it was, for an additional extension of whatever it was, 14, 21 days, I can't recall at the moment, Judge Norgal, as a matter of course, as he had always done, granted that extension. He had a longer call that morning, and Ms. Chapman couldn't be present. One of her younger associates was in the court, or Mr. Ryan, and Judge Norgal told us to leave the court, I mean, just to work out the dates on the briefing schedule. When we returned, after, you know, our turn came again, and he called us back, Judge Norgal had said, before you give me the date, I think it deceived me unintentionally, but you've deceived me in your papers, and you didn't, essentially saying you didn't inform me that you had that you missed the date in filing that June 5 document. It so happened that there was no record of it in the computerized records of the court. This happened two or three times in this case, unfortunately, errors in the clerk's office, and he absolutely refused to waver from the fact that I attempted to tell him that it was filed.
Well, why were the deadlines so hard to meet in this?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Well, I had hip replacement surgery.
There's quite a few extension requests.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I had hip replacement surgery, and I was out. I just, a month ago, it was over a year, it was the second time it failed. And the result was I had a shattered, as a result of the failure, I didn't put that in any of the papers because I felt it was my business, but the other side knew, I had a shattered thigh. it broke in three. I'm not blaming anyone, nature probably, but really I don't know what happened. But regardless, the result was the recovery was really very strenuous, very difficult. I only was able to work half days. I was in therapy, physical therapy, all that time. And I had all the cases backed up. I had four cases in this court, all of which were, three of them were argued at the end of May, and this was the last one. I think there was another one as well. I had lots of other cases. I practiced by myself, but I had lots of, I do have a partner, named partner. He's in Washington. He does other things. We both take on causes for the business community in different forms, but he's on his own. In certain matters, we get together. So I really do practice by myself. I didn't mention any of that because, you know, I really thought I could meet the schedules. It just so happened that in this particular case, I really wanted to submit it on cross motions for summary judgment, and the record got so big and voluminous that working on the cross motions, given the positions they had taken on their initial motion, got to be very difficult, and that's why I needed the extra time. But the fact was that since we've opened that issue, that is the abuse issue, when the judge, I knew the judge didn't do anything intentionally because it wasn't in the record, so nothing he could do. So the following day, I got back to my office. I immediately drafted a motion for reconsideration, included all the documents, including the missing document, and tried to explain it. So the reason I was there that day was the summary judgment motion. This was the ninth I was there. 2 days later, the summary judgment motion, which was a Friday, he only hears matters on Fridays, had been set down. And I had plans to be out of the country in Canada at the Stratford Festival with my family and old friends. We get together every year. I worked as a waiter 50 years ago, and we get together. And so I really couldn't do it. I mean, obviously I could have. Anything's possible, but this was planned. So I asked her, and she was kind enough to do it. She was an officer of the court to represent my side. She got to court, and what was up was not only her summary judgment motion, but also my motion for reconsideration, which I attempted to explain everything to the judge. I'm speaking a little faster because I'm running out of time here. But the judge absolutely refused to hear the reconsideration, claiming that it wasn't properly presented because I wasn't there. Now, she could have done it, and I'm not blaming her at all. But the fact is the judge was such a stickler for saying it wasn't presented when I wasn't there, he wouldn't let her present it. And so the result was he would never rule on the reconsideration motion, and he granted summary judgment. He granted it without ever hearing any argument, any facts, and of course their facts were deficient. I attempted one more time to bring this back to the court. He issued two different orders, labeled final orders, and I filed Rule 59e motions in both cases. He denied the first one on August 1, and I was well over the 15-page limit because originally he said we could go over the 15-page limit in this case. He said that wasn't applicable here. So anyhow, that afternoon I managed to get the corrected document in within the 15-page limit. And again, the document was lost in the court. And so even though I filed it properly and it was date stamped and everything else, the upshot is that's when she raises raises the fact that notice of appeal wasn't timely filed. The fact is it was timely filed. The judge actually, if you look at the Racer or Pacer printouts, he set a briefing schedule, and we all briefed my second 59E motion, which was really the only valid one because it was the only one from a proper final order. And we briefed it all the way into September. The judge actually granted extensions.
How many of these Rule 59 motions do you get to file?
Well, for Rule 59 motion, Your Honor, it's all under 59. It's really a motion for reconsideration, the first one. There's only one.
The first one was denied.
The first one was...
You have 30 days to...
Yes, Your Honor, but the first one was not a Rule 59 motion because it turned out he on his own entered a second order, which was a final order. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't believe that was a truly 59E motion. However, I recognized that the second one having so the only ruling 59E motion was the one I filed on August 1 on the 10th day. And that one, in fact, was not ruled upon until February 19, 2004, at which time he ruled on the wrong document. He ruled on my motion for leave to file it because I wanted to explain what was going on. And again, the document was lost. He again set a briefing schedule. That made it impossible for me to file a proper appeal following the 59E ruling because the briefing schedule went beyond the 30-day time. So on the 30th day, I had to file the appeal, and we never had a ruling on the 59E motion. However, as I point out in my papers, the appendices My time is no. I got to finish here. The appendices to the first 59E motion were the same as the second appendices. I just retyped something that had written handwritten. Let me briefly address in the time remaining. I may be short on my response time. The what I wanted to address was the principal issue in the case, Your Honors. The case of Moglia versus Gohagan, I commend it, really. I hope you will follow it. It's a Second Circuit decision. I cite it. That case is on all fours. I know counsel say that. I'm hearing it for years and years. In this case, there never was a signed agreement. Ever in this case. And this is consistent, and this is followed, in fact, in Gary v. Birchler, where the court acknowledges that distinguishing that case from Gary, that case is also therefore to be distinguished from every case she cites in her papers and in her brief. In every one of the cases this court has considered, Your Honors, there was a signed agreement earlier on. There was either an actual signed agreement, doesn't have to be signed, there was an actual agreement, or the employer was a party to a multi-employer bargaining group. And if you look at the language of Section 302, not just 302C5B, which is involved here, it is clear that the agreement has to be between an employer of the employees involved, which specifically spells out the terms for and conditions of work for the purpose of the fund. So it really refers to a collective bargaining agreement. The fact is, she is making the argument here that the agreement is the agreement with a company that had the similar name, Banner Restorations, was a totally different company, operated in a totally different way, and she's trying to say that's the agreement. That's not this employer. She doesn't make the very basic arguments for successorship to prevail on successorship. She cites two cases, one a second circuit case, the case which specifically is distinguishable, because in that case as well there was an agreement in the first place. And in fact, in the Moglia case itself, there was another case that was discussed, the Dunbar case. And in the Moglia case, the Dunbar was a situation where the agreement was lost. It's only in a situation where you can show there was some agreement that you get to the whole concept of adoption and ratification. And therefore, there can't be any adoption and ratification here where there never was an agreement. And that's actually made clear, Your Honors, even by Judge Easterbrook in the Moriarty versus Lewis case, where he points out that if there never was an agreement, the money has to come back. The money can't be held. The funds have to take it out of the pension monies. So therefore, we say it is very clear here. They haven't met the basics for summary judgment. And the other argument they make is that the form on the bottom was signed a few times by my client, the submission form. And that, again, in this particular case, is faulty. Look at the Lewis case, Judge Easterbrook's case. In that case and all the cases, if you find the form, what's necessary to have a ratification, assuming there is an agreement, which there isn't, that has to refer to a collective bargaining agreement. All her form refers to is a trust agreement. A trust agreement is not between an employer. It's a trust indenture between the trustees. An employer is never party to a trust agreement. So there's no way they can backdoor and claim there was an agreement, which is absolutely mandatory and required under the statute and under all of the cases, Your Honors. I reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Chapp.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Chapman, and I represent the Appalachians, the Local 52 Fringe Benefit Funds. The Local 52 Pension Fund currently pays pensions to 7 former employees of Banner Restorations. In addition, during the 8 years that Banner Restorations paid contributions to the welfare fund, all the employees that did bargaining unit work for Local 52 received welfare benefits. In 2000, Banner Restorations filed a lawsuit against the Local 52 Fringe Benefit Funds, requesting a refund for all the amounts it paid for the welfare and pension benefits. This court has already rejected the concept of returning contributions for benefits that employees have already received in Casper Trucking in 1993 and in Gustafson in 2001. As a consequence, at the completion of discovery on February 14, 2003, the Local 52 Fringe Benefit Funds filed a motion for summary judgment. Due to Banner Restoration's failure to file a response brief on any of the dates requested by Banner in April, in May, or in June, On July 1, 2003, the Local 52 Fringe Benefit Funds filed a motion with the district court requesting that it grant their motion for summary judgment. On July 8, Banner Restorations requested an additional 14 days to file a response brief, and on July 9, the district court denied that request. And then on July 11, granted the fund's motion for summary judgment. Since that date, Banner Restorations has filed approximately 9 motions with the district court and 6 motions with this court in a belated attempt to create a record to support the denial of the fund's motion for summary judgment. Perhaps due to the confusion caused by the number of motions filed, Banner Restorations filed its notice of appeal in an untimely manner. Even if this court finds that Banner Restoration's notice of appeal is timely, however, the district court's decision to decide the motion for summary judgment based on the records before it in July of last year was appropriate. In addition, the appeal has no factual or legal support, and under the Casper Trucking case, the Local 52 Fringe Benefit Funds are entitled to their attorney's fees for this appeal. First, the timely notice of an appeal is mandatory and jurisdictional. The final order in this case was entered on July 21, 2003. Banner Restoration.
Is that the second order or the first order?
That's the second one. Banner Restorations did file a Rule 59E motion on July 24, which was decided on August 1st. According to the rules, the time in which to file a notice of appeal would have been around September, on or before September 2, 2003. It appears that Banner Restorations is arguing that the time to file an appeal was extended because of the briefing schedule and because of the motion for leave to file an amended 59E motion. Under the appellate court rules, a motion for leave to file an amended motion is not a motion that stays the time or delays the time in which to file a notice of appeal. Accordingly, it's our position that the notice of appeal is untimely. Even if it is deemed timely, however, the district court did not abuse its discretion by denying the request for another extension. Under Rule 6B of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, the district court has the discretion to grant or deny requests for additional time for filing documents both before and after the documents were due. There's no abuse here. In this case, the court denied.
So most of the extension requests were made after the deadline had expired.
That's correct. All of them were made after the deadline had been expired. It appears that Banner Restorations is arguing that because one of the motions for an extension was lost, the district court erred in denying the motion in July for an additional extension. Under the Rule 6B, I don't believe that that's a reasonable argument. At the point that the court denied an additional extension, the response brief was already months overdue. In addition, it was appropriate to grant the motion for summary judgment based on the record the court had in front of it. It's undisputed that the company went through a course of conduct that supported that it was bound to a collective bargaining agreement with Local 52. It's also true that the coercion that Banner Restorations argues was a reason for the contributions has already been ruled by this court as not coercion, since those the undisputed facts are that the union said they would picket if the company did not comply with the collective bargaining agreement. That's not coercion, that's a legal action. And this court has found that. And specifically, the Seventh Circuit found that in September of this year, in another case between the Bricklayers Local 21 Fringe Benefit Funds and Banner Restorations, where the court found that you don't need a signed written agreement, you just need an agreement like the collective bargaining agreement. You don't need a signed agreement when you've got actions that show that they're complying with the agreement, like submitting contributions every month for over 8 years at the appropriate rates. For example, another thing is the company got employees from the union. The company cooperated with an audit by the fringe benefit funds. So for a period of over 8 years, they were complying with the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. And this court found in September that that type of action shows that the company is bound, regardless of whether there's a signed agreement or not.
And they complied with those requirements by paying benefits, Banner, that is?
Yes, that's correct.
After they incorporated?
Yes. That is another issue that the company has raised, that there's not enough elements of a successor liability. Under the current case in September, regardless of whether there's a successor or not, the current company complied with the agreement as a consequence of their own actions. Finally, as stated above, as I stated earlier, the Seventh Circuit has found in Casper Trucking and in a case called Gustafson that it's not appropriate to return money when employees have already received the benefit. This fact has not been addressed in this appeal or at any time in this litigation. There's no support for return of contributions. And under the Casper Trucking, the court found that an action for return for contributions is not substantially justified. And in that case, the Seventh Circuit found it appropriate to grant the funds their attorney's fees incurred in defending the appeal. In conclusion, the Local 52 Fringe Benefit Funds respectfully request that the appellate court uphold the district court's decision and to award the funds their attorney's fees incurred as a consequence of this appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time? You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the other decision, the arguments, ironically, raised by Judge Ripple, or made by Judge Ripple, of course, and it was not arguments, it was the decision, are almost identical to the arguments of counsel for the appellee. And for the same reasons that I urged you to not consider their position, Judge Ripple and that panel, unfortunately, from my point of view, but I believe, is wrong. Wrong because he attempts to distinguish Moglia by the later decision in the Second Circuit, which is not distinguishable. In fact, in that decision itself, Judge Winter, the chief judge of the Second Circuit, puts a footnote one or two, where he specifically says he's not disagreeing with Moglia at all. The law clerk who wrote this for Judge Ripple just didn't read that footnote. He points out that the difference in Moglia is there never was
a... Decisions of this court are written by the court, not
well, all right, I don't know
judges.
That.
So
right, they have to review it in any
Judge
event.
Judge Ripple, they're decisions of our court.
I don't mean to...
The Second Circuit.
Right, I don't mean to cast aspersions, but no, Your Honor. In the Moglia case, in that decision itself, that he used to distinguish Moglia by Chief Judge Winter of the Second Circuit, Judge Winter clearly makes it clear that the difference between that case, in fact, every case in this court, they recite Birchler as well, is that in Moglia there never was an agreement. Where there never was an agreement, it's a totally different circumstance. So that's respect. Also, with respect to Casper, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook's decision in that case, the fact is we're not asking the money to be returned here for those reasons at all. We specifically say we're not asking you to follow that. We're saying where there never was an agreement, just as Judge Easterbrook said in the Lewis case, the money can't be there. That's clearly against the section of the statute. And moreover, all of the matters recited in the decision by Judge Ripple of the other reasons are identical to the reasons in the Moglia case. In other words, the money was paid in, there was an audit, all of the same factors were there, and notwithstanding all those factors, you still can't have an agreement. The statute is very clear, Your Honors, and I am petitioning for cert in the other case. Thank you.
Thanks to counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move